And that's why romance is the subject of all human literature and all human life. I mean, we're made in that way, that we can't help but desire perfect union. That's spousal. Well, its realization, its ultimate realization, is not here on earth. No, the ultimate realization is in heaven. And that's what heaven is all about. That's the incredible beauty of Christ's promise of heaven, that we'll have a spousal union with God, in which... Okay, so Jesus is the bridegroom. And so is sex, is gender, does gender matter with regard to Jesus? I mean, is it just by chance that he came as a man? Could he have become incarnate as a woman? God's omnipotent. So if you just look at the power of God, of course he could have become man as a woman. But he didn't, for a good reason. Because he came man to be the bridegroom. And that means that the church in relationship to him is bride. Okay, so far so good? Does that make sense? Now the priest, the ordained priest, is ordained to do what? To act in the person of Jesus, the bridegroom of his church. And therefore, he has to, it's fitting that he physically represent Jesus also as bridegroom. And that requires male gender. And that's true of all the sacraments. In all the sacraments, Jesus could have made them however he wanted, no? Because Jesus chose the matter. So let's take baptism for a minute. Jesus chose the matter. And what did he choose? To baptize us?
Water.
But he could have chosen, if he wanted, mud. Right? He could have chosen it. But why wouldn't that be fitting? Right, because baptism is the sacrament of cleansing, of spirit cleansing us from sin. And so if he used mud, it would be a contradiction. It would be, or he could have used beer or coffee or something. Right? But likewise, that gets you dirty instead of getting you clean. Right? So he picked water for a reason. And we could go through all the sacraments and see the same thing. He picked, in the Eucharist, he picked bread and wine. Why? Because those are the staples of human nourishment in all cultures. And so he picked the most basic nourishment to use as the sacrament of spiritual nourishment. And so in holy orders, there's also a matter that is chosen to represent Jesus, bridegroom of the church. And part of that matter is male gender. Right? And so that's why he chose men. Not because they were holier. He had a choice, no? Between choosing Peter, Judas, and all the others, or his mother, Mary. It would seem like no contest. But he didn't choose Mary, and he chose instead Judas.
But if the case is that Jesus brought his bridegroom, I guess that argument to me makes sense. But when you referenced that Mary also brought Jesus into the world.
That's true. She brought him into the world. But she didn't act, that's true. See, what did she do? She did the supremely feminine thing. She received the Word of God into her body and brought him forth. I made an analogy to the priesthood with it, but it's not properly... she's not a priest like ordained ministers are priests. She brings him into the world, it's true, but she's... Okay, so what's Mary's... if we look at the church, what's Mary's role? We'll have a whole other evening on Mary. But her role, above all, is to be...
Mother of God.
Mother of God and also of the church. She's the mother of the church and the mother of each one of us. She is the supremely maternal role. And that's why women in the church, do they have an important role? Do they have an important... a model, as it were? Unbelievable, right? The holiest creature who ever was or even could be is Mary. And so she's the perfect model of woman's role in the church, which is, who's better, Mary or Peter? And Mary's a lot better. I mean, there's no, it's shattering. So the church is both Marian and Petrine. Does that make sense? In other words, we can say that the church is built on Peter. There's a Petrine, built on Peter, element to the church, which is the hierarchy, the priesthood, that looks male. And so somebody could get the idea, ooh, the church is male, because it has this male hierarchy. It's a patriarchal society. It's anti-feminine and so forth. That would be totally false. That would be to be actually blind about the nature of the church. Because which is the church more Marian or more Petrine? More Marian. Mary is the mother of the church. She's the heart of the church. She's the perfect icon of what the church is called to be. And therefore, women don't, they're not suffering discrimination by not being called to be priests like Peter and the others, because they have a no less noble role in the church, which is to be the heart of the church, to be the maternal face of the church. And in practice, that's so true. No, people like Mother Teresa do more for the to build up the church, I think, in the past century than anyone else. And we find that in every century, in every time. Okay? And so, just to go back to what we were saying before, the key thing is to realize that no one has a right to the priesthood. And that was represented very graphically in the Old Testament by the fact that you had to be not only male, but from one family. Okay, we don't require that anymore. You can be from any family. You can be from any race. You can speak any language. You can be from any condition, humble or noble, whatever. But you still have to be male, because that's the matter of the sacrament. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So, in going back to those moments that they had to be from that particular descendants of Aaron or Levite, well, obviously women had to be part of that.
Right, sure.
Before Jesus, then, were women allowed to be priests from those?
In the Old Testament? No. No, it's only... In the Old Testament, you had to be from the tribe of Levi, but the women weren't Levites. They couldn't serve in the temple. And there, they didn't know the full explanation, I suppose, because Jesus hadn't yet become man. But it was, in the Old Testament, women, even if they were descendants of Aaron, were not priests. Israel was unique in this, and this is very interesting. It's a good question. The other religions of the world did have priestesses. Was a very common thing. And it went together with, generally, with the female representation of God. All the religions of the world, with the only exception of Judaism, were polytheistic. No one said they had different deities, and some of those deities were male and some were female. And the female deities generally represented the earth mother, or nature as a deity. In other words, they divinized nature, the different religions of the world. And to... in the cult of the Earth Mother, very often what these religions of the world had were priestesses who represented the fecundity of Earth Mother by a terrible institution, the institution of temple prostitutes. So there were priestesses in these different religions who very often served as temple prostitutes. Anyway, I'm not saying that's the case in every culture. But it was the case in Canaan and many other places. And so Israel was unique in not having priestesses, precisely because it went together with a false view of God. The idea that God is nature. In other words, it's called pantheism. The idea that God is nature, whereas in reality, God transcends nature. God created nature. Nature is his creature. And so Israel didn't have priestesses precisely for that reason. Okay? Paul?
What is the church's teaching on female deaconesses? Because I know that some Protestant...
great question. Deaconesses.
Deaconesses, yeah.
Right. In the Old Testament, it didn't exist. But in the New Testament, in the letters of St. Paul, he refers in a few places... let me just say something first. So in the letters of St. Paul, women have a crucial role. Right? There's no doubt. In the building up of the church, women had just as an important role as men. It's just that they weren't ordained priests. Right? But nevertheless, we see in the Acts of the Apostles that very often the key figures in building up a church in a particular place were people like Lydia and Aquila and Priscilla. So in that case, it was a husband and wife, and the wife was the one who ended up evangelizing Apollos. So we see women exercising a big role, but not that of a not a priestly role. It's precisely an apostolic role, because all the members of the church are called to build up the church. And so Paul, in his letters, sometimes refers to these women as deaconesses. But you have to be careful about what that meant, because deacon means minister. It has an ordinary meaning in Greek. In English, it just has a technical meaning. We hear deacon and we think the first grade of holy orders, deacon, priest, and bishop. And I still have to explain that. But in Greek, deacon means someone who serves, someone who ministers. And so a deaconess would be someone who ministers who happens to be female. So that would be the reasonable way to interpret those texts. Not that Paul had ordained deaconesses, but simply that there were women who served the community in a very important way. Okay, so I think it would be a big mistake to think that in the early church there were deaconesses, because there's no trace of it after that.
So there are just women serving in the church and Paul called them that.
That's right.
But they were never ordained.
That's right. Okay. Right. There's no evidence that they were ordained deaconesses. Our earliest glimpses of canon law, knows nothing about it. It has only men at the different grades of holy orders. Let's say something about the grades of holy orders. So holy orders has three grades: deacon, priest, and bishop. And that was parallel to the Old Testament, which had three grades. There was the high priest, which was the eldest Aaron himself, and then his eldest son, and the descendant of the eldest son. In other words, the eldest son in the line of the eldest son was high priest. And then there were the other members of Aaron's family who were all priests. And then there were all the Levites who served what we would call deacons, who served the priests. Right? So in Israel, there were three grades: Levite, which would be deacon, priests, and high priest. And at the time of Jesus, who was the high priest? He's infamous. He has a bad name, for good reason. Caiaphas. And Caiaphas was the high priest. The high priest was one of the worst men who ever lived. Anyway, so initially there was three levels of the hierarchy of holy orders. And so in the church, it's natural that likewise there be three levels. And we see the deacons being instituted in chapter 6 of the Acts of the Apostles, because the apostles couldn't do everything. They needed some to be ordained for a specific purpose, above all to administer charity. And so that's the purpose of the deacon, to be the administrator of the charity of the church, and also to administer the body and blood of Jesus Christ. In other words, to be a server of communion, to give communion to the sick, and to give charity to the needy. Okay, so that was the function of the deacon. And it was a very important function in the early church. Deacons were tremendously important. And very often in the Church of Rome, the popes were chosen from those who previously were deacons. Okay. And then the priests would be those who had the power to consecrate the Eucharist and absolve sins. The deacon does not have that power. Right? So the deacon can't absolve and can't consecrate. He can officiate at baptism and weddings, but he can't administer the Eucharist or penance. Okay? Whereas the priest can. But the bishop is the one who serves as the head of the local church. And so the bishop is the one who has the fullness of holy orders. In other words, the bishop is the one who shares most fully in the role of Jesus Christ, high priest.
Father, and just as you're talking about deacons, just as priests, deacons, and bishops are all ordained,
the ordination of deacon is markedly different.
Mm-hmm.
It's ordination into service rather than the ministerial priesthood.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the words used in the prayer of ordination show what he's being ordained for, right? That he's being ordained for that service. Whereas in the ordination of a priest, the priest is being ordained to sacrifice, to offer the sacrifice of the Mass. That's his principal purpose, why a priest is ordained a priest. Right? To offer the perfect sacrifice of the Mass and to absolve sin. And then the bishop is ordained to serve as the head of the local church. And so he has the fullness of holy orders. And so the bishop, not only can he consecrate the Eucharist and minister penance, but he also has the power to ordain others. Right? And that's solely the power of the bishop. Right? A priest can't ordain, but only the bishop.
Mm-hmm. Thus, a deacon, like, he gets ordained a deacon.
Mm-hmm.
Remain a deacon? Or is it a step maybe to become a priest?
Right, well, both of those things are the case. So we have everyone who's ordained a priest was first ordained a deacon. And we call that he's a deacon temporarily, usually for about a year. Temporary deacon. But we also have revived, after the Second Vatican Council, the office of the permanent diaconate, which existed in the early church, but fell into disuse in the Middle Ages. And so that got revived. And so now we have people who are ordained to be deacons permanently. Right? And most churches have a permanent deacon. Okay? So both of them exist.
And Larry, last week I showed them some of the vestments,
uh-huh.
How to tell the difference between a priest and a deacon. And this isn't always true, but it's almost always true. So when you walk into a church and you want to know, is this a permanent deacon
mm-hmm.
or transitional deacon, look at their L, which is the white thing. And almost all permanent deacons have alves that are too short. Like their calves. I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's sacramental. But transitional deacons tend to have them down to about the end. So when you think, it's true here at the cathedral too. I'm just saying.
Right, the transitional deacon is the one who's ordained a deacon prior to becoming a priest the following year. Yeah.
So why would someone choose to be ordained a permanent deacon versus a priest?
Well, it would be, first of all, it's a different vocation, and normally the way it is today is that there are people who are older who become permanent deacons. Older men who, they can be married or not married. But that was something new in the church. So after the Second Vatican Council, it was made possible for a permanent deacon to not be celibate, to be a married man. Whereas in the early church, permanent deacons were always celibate.
But even now, if their wife dies, you know, the night after they're ordained, they don't remarry.
Right, they can't remarry. Because that's always been the case. Holy orders, even if a priest in the Eastern Church, no, the priests are not celibate, but you can't marry after you've been ordained, in East or West. So likewise for the permanent deacons. They can be married when they're ordained deacons, but they can't get married after. And there's a reason for this. It's because you're acting in the person of Christ, the bridegroom, and the church is your bride. And it would be a counter-symbolism if a priest were to celebrate marriage with a private person, because he's the bridegroom of his church. Right? And this is why it's more fitting that the priest be celibate. And that's why it was always the practice in the West for priests to be celibate. And it seems that it was the practice also in the East at the beginning, and that they changed it later because of a large number of cases of priests living in concubinage. But people are still fighting about that, so I don't want to get into that. But I think it's sufficient that there's a tremendous fittingness in the priest being celibate, because it means that he can dedicate himself wholly. It involves a gift of self to the church that's total. And that's very fitting. Even though a married priest can still validly exercise the priesthood. You know, and in the Catholic Church, here in the West, there are dispensations made for people who were Episcopalian priests, who were married, or some Lutherans, who, when they convert to Catholicism, they're given a dispensation such that they can be a Catholic priest and be married.
Do you mind? I get
the, no, no.
Waters more, but do you want to just make the distinction between celibacy being a discipline and, for example, maleness being
right.
Part of the valid form
right.
of matter?
So if a woman were to receive exteriorly the rite, which has happened, know that people have ordained women in the last decades, it's invalid. She does not become a priest. And that's because the church doesn't have the power to ordain a woman as a priest. It wasn't something that Jesus gave to his church. And there's something incredibly beautiful about this, because it shows us that the sacraments are not in our power. They're in Jesus' power. He's the head of the church. The church receives them as gifts, as incredible gifts. But we don't have the power. So we can't say, the church couldn't decide, from now on, the Pope can't make a document, I don't know, motu proprio, say, from now on, instead of bread in the Eucharist, the valid matter is whatever you like, rice. He can't do it. He can't write a document and say, the valid matter in baptism is wine or beer instead of water. Because Jesus instituted that. And likewise, the Holy Father can't write a document and say, from now on, a woman can be ordained a priest. Because the church did not receive that power from Jesus Christ. And that's what John Paul II declared, in, I think it was 1994, in a document called the Priestly Ordination, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. He declared that, very simply, that the church doesn't have the power. It's not that I want to or I don't want to. It's that the church did not receive that power from Jesus Christ. And therefore, if the rite is done exteriorly, nothing happens. It's like, suppose I were to take the bread and wine, God forbid, and say the words of consecration. Well, I'm not a priest. What happens? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And this is also what happens when an Anglican priest celebrates the Eucharist. What happens? Nothing happens. Why? Because he's not a validly ordained priest. And so nothing happens. And so likewise, if a woman's ordained, nothing happens. Right? The church doesn't have that power. And by the way, this is important to know. That document that John Paul II wrote about the impossibility to ordain women is infallible. He used the infallibility of the papal office. How do we know that? Because in the document, if you read it, he writes, the church does not have this power. And then he goes on to say, and this must be held definitively by all the members of the church. Well, in a papal document, if you see the word definitively, that means that the Pope wants to use his charism, his gift of infallibility. That something has to be held definitively by all the members of the church. That means that it can never change. That means that all the successors of John Paul II are bound by what he declared. Not that he declared it for the first time. He simply was confirming what was the case from the beginning. Right? So Benedict does not have the power. He could not do it. He could not write a document saying women can be ordained. And nor can Benedict's successor, whoever it may be. Right? Okay, so that would be invalid. Now, something else is priestly celibacy is not required for validity. It doesn't make a priest an invalid priest if he's married and if he makes use of his marriage. It's just that that's not the practice in the Western Church, in the Latin Church, for very good reasons. Okay? That could change. I don't think it'll ever change. I think there's absolutely no possibility of it changing. But if it did change, it would simply be a prudential decision of the Holy Father. Because that's a matter of discipline. All right? But what's a matter of doctrine, I think, is the fittingness. That it's more fair. And that's because it has to do with what we were talking before, that the priest is bridegroom of the church. Okay? So an example of that was that there a change was made with regard to permanent deacons. So prior to the Second Vatican Council, deacons, permanent deacons in the Latin Rite, couldn't be married. And now they can, right? Because that's a disciplinary change. But nevertheless, they still can't get married once they've been ordained because of the symbolism.
You can see in the gospel that many of the apostles and the early priests were
Right, and the chief example of that is Peter, right? Peter, we have a mention of his mother-in-law, right? So Peter was very clearly married. But what we don't find is Peter's wife going around with him after he's been ordained. And that was what the early church understood, is that you could be married before you were ordained, but in the early church, once you were ordained, you had to live like brother and sister, and you're now married to the church. You're still married, I mean, the marriage is still valid to your wife, it's just that your wife had to consent to your living like brother and sister. And without that consent, you couldn't be ordained. Right? So, when you hear about married priests in the early church, it doesn't mean that they're exercising their matrimony, having relations with their wife. Yeah, because that was against the earliest canons that we have about the priesthood. Anyway, that's a matter of history.
Where does a cardinal fit in? You talk about deacons, priests, and bishops.
Right.
There's cardinals.
Right. That's not a difference of holy order. So there are only three grades of holy orders. Deacons, priests, and bishops. And let's take, what about the Pope? Is that a different grade of holy orders? No. What is he?
Bishop.
Simply a bishop. The bishop of Rome. Right? So the bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter, and thus has that ministry of primacy in the church. Now the successor of Peter is a bishop like all the other bishops, but he has a special role of service to be the principle of unity in the church. And he's the one who, in effect, unifies the church by being one visible vicar of Christ. What about the cardinals? Well, the cardinals are, today they are bishops. But in the past, they didn't even have to be bishops. They're simply, in their origin, they were, I guess it was the priests in the Diocese of Rome were the cardinals. But today, the purpose of the cardinals is to serve as advisors to the Pope and electors of the next Pope. And so their principal function is those two things, to serve, to advise the Pope, and we call that the Curia, the Roman Curia at the Vatican, and they would be the heads of the different, what we call congregations or dicasteries, and they help the Pope govern the church. And then they have this incredibly important job of electing a new pope. And it's the pope who appoints who is a cardinal. And after a certain age, they can't elect, they can't vote anymore. They're still cardinals, but they don't elect the pope.
And there's a certain number of voting cardinals, too.
Right.
120.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's something that can change. Because this is that's a human institution, the cardinals. Whereas holy orders is a divine institution, right? It's instituted by Christ. So many things in the way the church is governed are of human origin and can change, but not holy orders. And it's three grades. Now one more thing. So we've talked about ordained priests. What about the laity? Scripture speaks about the whole people of God as also exercising a priesthood. We call that the common priesthood of the faithful. And what does that consist of? Does anybody know? If the priest's principal task, the ordained priest, is to offer the Eucharist, well, the common priesthood of the faithful is to offer it with the priest and to offer ourselves with him. In other words, to share in the worship of God in the church, that we have that power through baptism. So baptism gives us a certain share in Christ's priesthood, but it's completely dependent on the ordained priest. Because if there's no ordained priest offering the sacrifice of the Mass, how can we participate in it? Right? We can't. So our common priesthood depends on the existence of the ordained priesthood in the church.
And it's a difference of essence, and not
right,
degree.
Right. It's not that We're almost there. Right? Because only the priest, only the ordained priest, acts in the person of Christ. We act, the common priesthood of the faithful, acts in the person of the church, the bride.
And the ministerial priesthood is at the service of the common priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sort of...
Right, it's a beautiful...
Connected.
Uh-huh, right. Right, he serves, and vocation to the priesthood is a vocation to tremendous service. And in the confessional, in the Eucharist, and in governing the church, in catechesis. And so we're called to cooperate with that, but we, without the priest, we can't properly cooperate. Because we need the forgiveness of sins, and we need the priest to consecrate the Eucharist. It's true that in certain, there were cases in Japan after a terrible persecution, that the church survived for centuries without priests. But it's a completely, it's an unbelievable tragedy. And we take it for granted, right? We tend not to be thankful, as we should be, for the gift of having priests in our church. So we always have to pray for our priests and support them in any way we can. That's one of our most important duties, to pray for vocations and to support our priests. Okay, any questions on that? All right.
One final thing. The priesthood of the laity, you see this in the documents of Vatican II especially, is exercised most powerfully and effectively outside of church.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. So that's been a mistake by many people in trying to put the priesthood of the people at work in, you know, at Mass.
Right, to be up on the altar.
To be in the same, yeah. And the beauty of the common priesthood that we have in baptism is that the laity goes places that I as a priest can't go, because I'm not a tax lawyer or a mechanic, or, I mean, these are places where I'm not going to be spreading the gospel, so to speak. But that the people who are part of the common priesthood do every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is so important. Basically, the common priesthood is this, to participate in the sanctification of the world. And how do we do that? It means, above all, the sanctification of our daily life. And so in practice, if we're a married person, the common priesthood is sanctifying our marriage by loving our spouse and our kids, by being good parents, by working for the glory of God, by trying to do good work, to serve society in whatever way we can, to spread the faith by example, to spread the faith by teaching our children, to spread the faith by speaking to our friends. And so that's the exercise of the common priesthood of the faithful is precisely the penetration of the gospel everywhere, into all that we do. And that's why to be a Catholic isn't simply, I don't know, something ritual, right? To go to church on Sundays. Right? Being a Catholic means that all of our life be permeated with Jesus Christ. And that's why it would be such an error to think that the common priesthood of the faithful means to, I don't know, be an extraordinary minister of Eucharist. I mean, okay, if God calls us to some special ministry, that could be. But that's not 99.9% of the common priesthood of the faithful is living our life in Christ. And that's our fundamental participation in the Eucharist. That in the offering of the Eucharist, when the priest elevates the host, what we should do is offer our life in all of those dimensions with Christ. But that means that we have to be living in such a way that we can do that. Which also means that, in practice, that we have to make use of the sacrament of penance. Otherwise, we won't be able to do that.